Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. It's time for dry dock episode. For
dry dock. Forgotten fleets, isn't it?
I have been spending a week and a half recording the Patreon dry dock, and it is taken over my brain. I apologize. Let's try this again.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Bilge Pumps, episode 67. Today, we are joined by the regular crew. So that's Jamie from Armored Carriers, Dr. Clark from AC Naval History, and myself, Drakinafel, plus one fluffy research assistant who's trying to steal the Iron Brew.
Two fluffy research assistants, because I'm fairly sure Jamie's is also there as well. But not trying to steal Iron Brew. Trying to steal probably... And do you have a nice Shiraz today, or a beer, or
the study is beer at the moment?
Oh, good lord!
So for today, our subject for discussion is, well, we're going to give you a break from AUKUS and Australian submarines, since we've done that for 3 years. But somewhat predictably, despite the fact that AUKUS said nothing explicitly about China. China is not been very happy in the past few weeks for some reason. So we're going to talk a little bit about what they've been doing and possibly why. Can't imagine.
Yeah. Although, let's be honest, the headline grabbing thing that most of you will notice is they said they don't want external spectators to come to the Olympics. And was I the only one who went, "Hey, we're not going to have to deal with all the people going to the Olympics getting together"? Because wherever it comes from, let's be honest, if everyone goes to the Olympics, that will become a coronavirus hotspot, which will then respread back around the world. And yeah,
It's a good way to repurpose a sensible coronavirus containment strategy, I would say.
Yeah. It just makes things a little bit easier on that front. But no, what China are having fun. The latest pictures of their aircraft carrier are pretty darn cool.
That'll be coming out quite quickly.
Yes. Almost as if someone's been planning it for quite a while and they're now just assembling the components.
They sort of did the same thing with Shandong. That came together very quickly. But, you know, they've got the economy for it. They've got the manpower for it. Got people power for it, and they've got the shipyards for it. So, I guess, you know, this is what we saw with the United States in the lead up to World War II. It was all it needed was a button to be pressed to get those Liberty ships rolling off the lines. Not to mention the Clevelands and the Fletchers and the any other class of vessel you would care to name of. Once you've got your economy primed and your core assets, i.e. your slipways, in place, then, you know, all you need to do is press the button.
Well, it's the joy is the scenario is that this is, of course, what a benefit of having building brand new shipyards, because they don't have orders on the books to deal with before they deal with your order.
Yeah, I suppose, but that sort of only lasts for the first job, doesn't it? Because there's always going to be more jobs.
If we consider what China's been recently doing with some of their shipyards, they've been moving them wholesale and making them about five times the size that they were. Right. So that does kind of help, because, okay, yes, they've still got orders on the books, but they've now got five times as much space, and you can't tell me they're carrying many of their orders over from their old site to their new site.
Well, they've also got the advantage going on there of... if they're by building new infrastructure, they can tailor that infrastructure to the size and scale that they need it to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back at the interwar period, even the pre-World War One and World War One periods, it's one of the biggest chains around France's ankle was the fact that their shipyard, although they had a very extensive shipyard industry and infrastructure set up, because so much of it was basically the age of sail stuff they'd set up just with slightly newer cranes and things, it meant that they didn't have much in the way of size, so they were constantly having to make incremental improvements to the overall size of their shipyards to try and address the next generation of capital ships and how big they were going to be, and in some cases cruisers, not helped by the sort of the pause they had on large ship construction with the Je Nicole. And as a result, they found themselves, one, with a very limited number of slipways that could accommodate large capital ships, and two, once they'd actually started building them, they realized that even then, most of those weren't actually big enough, hence why the Richelieu's had to be completed as a large hull section, but then with the stern and bow bolted on separately afterwards.
And this continued on with the Charles de Gaulle class aircraft carrier, of course.
Mm.
And then of course, the Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, the Queen Elizabeth. You're basically getting out the file to take off any unusual protuberances down to the size of a pebble just to get them out the dock gates.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the folding down mast to get under the bridge. And when you see, I mean, to be honest, even going a little bit further back, when you see some of the pictures of Hood under construction, a lot of the size limitations that were in place on Hood and later on the G3s weren't down to, can we build a ship this size? It was down to, do we have the infrastructure to support a ship this size when it's actually actively in service? Albeit that with Hood, there are some absolutely hilarious pictures of the hull kind of on the slipway and then extending aggressively past the slipway and over the railway that was at the end of the slipway and into the buildings that were on the other side of the railway at the end of the slipway. And they could only build on that particular slipway because there was a tributary of the river that the yard was on directly opposite, because if they launched it off of any of the other slipways, it would slam into the riverbank on the other side. And the US is now in, to be honest, in something of a similar situation in that they've got one yard with dockyards and infrastructure capable of building and supporting their carriers. They had another one, but it shut down. So they'd have to re-enable that one, which would come up with a lot of costs. And there's not a tremendous amount of large shipping construction infrastructure on much of a scale down from that. I mean, we've talked previously about, you know, would it be a good idea for the US to have some kind of adapted Queen Elizabeth class as their light carriers? But the fact is that in terms of military capable shipyards, the US has precious little that could even build something that size. There's a huge drop from there down to things like the LPDs and the LHDs, etc., that they build, which is kind of the next ship size down for military construction, which it does put something of a bottleneck on how quickly they can build large ships. Whereas if China's sitting there going, all right, we have a plan, we want large capital ships in the future, we know how big these large capital ships are going to be, we'll allow a little bit for growth, and you know what, we're just going to build the port infrastructure and the dockyards, etc. now anyway, well, given how tightly regulated some of the Chinese economy is, it gives them a kind of a dual purpose advantage in that they can have the shipyard capacity there ready to build vast numbers of modern large capital ships if they so choose. But also, from a civilian side, if they have a shipyard that's capable of mass production of large hulls, that could also give them a bit of an edge into leveraging themselves into the global large shipping market, which, as I'm sure if we had Sal along with us, would be telling us, has some issues at the moment trying to find enough hulls to transport all the containers.
I don't think it's the hulls that's the problem. I think it's the problems actually the offloading of the containers.
I thought the problem was the number of containers they had in the market, that they actually had not, they had designed the hulls, the number of containers for one market, and they've just realized that whilst they've got actually multiple yards that can produce ships, they've actually got less places that actually produce shipping containers.
Yeah, it could be that too, I suppose. Yeah. Anyway, I imagine the problem is related with the queues, obviously, but just chaos in general. Look, you know, it's the same old problem, isn't it? When you've got the shipyards that can do the job, then you've got flexibility. When you don't have the shipyards that don't do the job, or when you don't have the shipyards that do the job, then you've got to scrabble for compromise. I think, you know, we saw that with the Royal Navy to a degree in the lead up to World War II, with the size of its capital ships. And, you know, it was obviously a bit of a near-run thing when it came to the Queen Elizabeth's. So, you know, I think now...
And honestly, let's be honest, the Queen Elizabeth's, I love them dearly, but they... If you had the option of making them 40 to 50 metres longer, you would have done it. Because that would have given you a lot of capability for no extra cost. And probably actually made your hull more fuel efficient and speedier. Because add that on, and I'm doing the mental calculations in my head, you gain enough space for an extra 6 F-35s, at least in the hangar. You gain all sorts of other things you can add in, and you can spread out the ship and in stores, etc. But you don't need any really extra, any crew. You don't need anything extra in terms of the big expensive stuff. You just get a lot of space, and you get that more efficient hull form. Because as we all know, hull form's efficiency do tend to be length to breadth. And the higher your length to beam ratio, the usually more efficient and faster your hull.
Which means the further you can go, carrying more.
And if you're operating F-35Bs, an extra 40 to 50 metres in hull length, in overall length, gives you a very, very nice runway that can really assist with launching positions for helicopters, but also gives your aircraft a little bit further to take off.
It also probably gives you some space to put those containers and crates without having to lash them down in the middle of the hangar.
Don't get me started.
Although I do find it interesting that the classic shape of a carrier with the sort of the 21st century carriers seems to be changing compared to what we think of, because you've got the World War I carriers, which are... they're the straight deck ones. Then you've got almost everything that's built in the Cold War that's an actual carrier, not on a sneaky attempt to get past Parliament, which has an angled flight deck. So everybody's got this idea that, you know, a quote-unquote modern carrier has this very pronounced port side angle to it. And then you have a look at the 21st century carriers. So that's the Queen Elizabeth, the Fords, and now the Type 003s, or Type 003 singular, I think. And they're all kind of filling in that aft port quarter gap that was present before. In the Ford class, they've stuck an aircraft lift there. Don't know quite what the 003s are doing, but probably using it for additional deck parking, and of course the Queen Elizabeth's as well. So the new 21st century carrier is kind of this slightly rounded rectangle of a flight deck, just very wide with a tapering point bow. So it's just an interesting engineering observation, but in a lot of ways we've almost gone back to the era of the straight deck carrier, just a lot wider.
To be fair, because these things need space, if you consider the Queen Elizabeth class, it's been designed to operate Chinooks, F-35s, Merlins, all sorts of things. And you need space. That's what becomes the overall priority. I always hate it when people describe aircraft carriers as floating airfields. But in many, because that misses out so much on their complexity. And as I know, I do like that Caspar John quote. But basically, the fact is, the flight deck is like an airfield. And as with all airfields, your capability of operations depend on the space you have available. Especially when you're operating a stall aircraft carrier like the British are. It needs space. But this is moving away from China. Which is,
we are talking about China
because, you know, their 003 is looking like an interesting design.
And it's an intermediate step in a lot of ways, because they've got the Type 00, theoretically at least, they've got the Type 004s on plan, which are going to be kind of theoretically up there with the Nimitzes and the Fords. But the what's now looking to be the projected displacement, etc., of the Type 003, sorry, yeah, is it's this intermediate step between supercarriers, because the Forrestals and the Kitty Hawks theoretically about 60,000 tons empty, going up towards 80,000 tons fully loaded, but this Type 003, size-wise and displacement-wise, it's kind of sitting at the midpoint between the 60,000-ton conventional supercarriers and then the 100,000-ton plus 100 to 110,000-ton Nimitzes and Fords, because it's sitting at just at the low 80s.
Well, it's supposed to be roughly 85,000 tons fully loaded. So empty probably is, it definitely is in the low 80s. And it's one of the interesting things that I keep seeing when people keep talking about it, and what is called the Project 1143.7, the Ulyanovsk, the Soviet carrier. And honestly, you take a look at this sort of the latest Soviet design, the one which was ordered in 1986 and stricken in 1991 after 40% completion. You take a look at that design and you take a look at the Type 003. And there are similarities there. But the thing is, you can see there are similarities, I think, not because of terms of the Chinese getting the technology from the Russians. I think it's similarities because when you're looking at roughly this 80,000 ton, how are you going to maximize the capabilities from those 80,000 tons?
It'd be interesting to see what kind of air group it ends up carrying, because, of course, aircraft have changed. So are we going to see an aircraft? Are we going to see a carrier that's capable of sort of taking maybe something along the size of a historical Forrestal or Kitty Hawk class air group, only with bigger and heavier modern aircraft? Or are they going to try and use maybe slightly smaller aircraft than the US uses to try and get a similar size air group out of a smaller hull? Or is it going to be some kind of intermediate step? And is there even an intermediate step in terms of air group for that?
I think you have to consider the amount of development the Chinese are doing in terms of their aircraft carriers. I do see the Type 003 as being a transition to, well, the first two carriers, 1 and 2, have been definitely been test beds. They are test beds. They're testing air groups. They're testing all these things about. I think the Type 3 is transitioning from testbed carriers to a full-on carrier, but I don't think it's quite there yet. I think it's still going to be partially a testbed, so I wouldn't be surprised if you do see a fair amount of change around the air group. And I think especially once you've got the Fours in production and 1 and 2 go, 3 will become the one where they're using for testing aircraft, because it'll be the easiest one to take off the line and use as a test bed, and if something happens to it, well, that's annoying, but that's our second rate carrier to an extent compared to our Type 4s. I think the interesting thing is what exactly they decide to put in the air group in terms of uncrewed versus crewed aircraft. Because this is the thing which could potentially be a disruptor. Because if the Chinese put the first proper uncrewed squadron at sea, it doesn't matter if they really achieve operational status after, they don't. If they've got enough out there, they can claim they've achieved it, then there's going to be a lot of, and we can all imagine them, that various, because there aren't the defense specialist journalists they used to be. You know, the Jamies are quite rare in this world.
I'm definitely not a specialist, that's for sure. I'm one of the others.
Yeah, the you're far closer to a specialist than most of the others, who are will see that and will immediately report that the West has fallen behind China. And then there'll be a knee-jerk reaction from Congress and Parliament and everyone else, as there often is when these things happen, demanding rapid deployment of our own uncrewed squadrons to carriers, which could cause all sorts of fun. So that's the thing I'm waiting. I have this sneaking suspicion that that will be what the Chinese will do with the Type 003. I have a suspicion that they will disrupt everyone, because quite a few people are patting themselves on the back going, oh, we've deployed an old F-35 squadron. Woo-hey, we've got this fifth generation fighter. And that's lovely. But
in IOC.
But yes, we can talk about its actual capabilities in a bit. But the thing is, no one has yet deployed a full uncrewed squadron as part of a carrier air group in terms of a proper UCAV. I'm not talking about something which is for aerial refueling or something which is for, you know, just reconnaissance or one of those rotor ones they sometimes stick up there to provide aerial security when they're in harbour. A proper UCAV strike squadron. And to be honest, I wouldn't be surprised, because the Chinese are doing a lot of aircraft development.
Well, their air show earlier this week
had
quite a bit of rather large uncrewed aircraft on display. Not to mention the progress being made on their other designs. So, but I mean, the point is that once again, that they seem to be prepared to do things by steps. They don't want to just, you know, they're willing to take time, get it right, I suppose, or at least find the errors and then build upon that, which, you know, I sort of think perhaps we should have tried that with something like the LCS. Perhaps we should have tried something like that with the Zumwalt. Perhaps we should have tried something like that with the F-35. Instead of going from zero to hero, well, not zero, but trying to get the hero league off the bat, as opposed to actually building up to it.
That's the trouble half the time with these things. We do try to jump straight in, and we go with computer simulations, which are very good, but the old problem with the computer is garbage in, garbage out. It's the quality of the programmer when you're building a computer simulation.
I've been trying to think of what would be the theoretical air group for a 003. And if we were talking conventionally, you probably want four squadrons of strike aircraft, a squadron of helicopters. So that's just five squadrons. So that takes you up to a minimum of 60 aircraft. And then you're reserving some of your capacity for your ancillary stuff, your carrier onboard delivery, any AWACS style stuff, etc., you might have outside of your ASW helicopter squadron. But if we then start getting drones involved with their smaller footprint, the question is, what kind of drones are you using, and what aircraft are they replacing or complementing?
Well, I think the Chinese, if they're going to go for squadrons of aircraft, they're talking about the J-15s. Because this is the first sort of proper carrier they're building. They could go with Sukhois, but they've put the J-15s, they've developed them, they've got them in service, they're batch free of them as starting, which is kind of auspicious to go with the type 3 aircraft carrier. And so I think it could be a variant on the J-15.
Yeah, but what I mean is, if they okay, China's still in its experimental phase. They might be treating the 003 as a experiment, but on a bigger scale, kind of Liaoning and Shandong are, can we do carriers? And then whatever this thing's going to be named is, okay, now we know we can do carriers. How do we do the carrier air group that we want for the future? Because if you take that kind of baseline air group, you could have anti-submarine drones, like the US is experimenting with. I think they're called Fire Scouts, they? Something like that?
They have been testing. The fire scouts have been around for a little while, but I think they are testing the anti-submarine role with
that. Yeah. So in that case, you could say, I don't know, you take 8 helicopters instead of 12, and instead of your other four ASW helicopters, you stick in another 8 to 12 ASW drones because they take up less space. So you're increasing your ASW group. Or do you maybe take 3 squadrons of strike aircraft, and instead of the remaining squadron, you try and pack in 2 squadrons worth of loyal wingman drones or something like that?
But are we approaching this the wrong way around? Shouldn't we be figuring out what they would most likely be using these carriers for first? Because I suspect that their needs are rather dramatically different to that of the United States. And we are once again sort of painting them with the brush that we have become quite familiar with using, which at the same time we're also well aware didn't apply the last time around when you try and compare British armored carriers with
American and Japanese.
Yeah,
China's challenges are, of course, its primary seas. The East and South China Seas are largely, well, not landlocked as such, but certainly island chained. They've only got a few narrow sort of choke points to traverse if they want to enter the wide open world. And beyond that, there's another island chain, this one with centered on Guam. So, when you're looking out the other end of the barrel, what use is a carrier for you there? Well, I personally imagine it would have to be something to do with running those choke points, surely. Where you'd be expecting your SSNs, where you'd be expecting your loitering munitions, where you'd be expecting your B-1 and B-52 patrols to carry into their envelope. Other than that, the only other thing I can think of a super carrier's use with China being is a great big flag-waving exercise, which I don't think they're crazy.
I think what you're looking at is there are two things. This is also why I think of uncrewed aircraft being there, because I think with that chain, they're going to be looking at attritional warfare to an extent. And whilst we do sometimes talk about the size of the Chinese military, etc., they are not that crazy, as you put it. They don't want to lose all sorts of people when they don't have to. So for reconnaissance, for some of the strikes against some of those island, some parts of the island chain, they probably do want an uncrewed aircraft. And also, there is the legacy of the one-child policy in China. Now, there are all sorts of reports about it, but we all know it has had an impact on their population. It has had an impact on their organization, their structure, and it's going to have a legacy in terms of the next 20 to 30 years when certain other issues come to head with it within the population, which is another reason for them to go for uncrewed aircraft, because the reality is they're going to have between the changing from the one-child policy and the one-child policy being implemented, there is going to be a bit of, there has been a sort of, is a sort of cliff edge coming in terms of their personnel numbers. And if they're going to keep growing and strengthening their force and their ability to break out of the island chain, which is their important thing, because their important thing is the island chain is both a defensive mechanism, but it's also, as you point out, a restrictor. And if they can't break out of it, then that very nice defensive position they have becomes the noose around their own neck because they can't break out around it. So this is where I think uncrewed aircraft, and again, why I see the Type 003 is where they bring this in. They've worked out how to operate carriers, they developed their carriers, and now they need a slightly larger platform because you need a larger air group if you're going to start working out how to integrate uncrewed and crewed aircraft into your carrier. And this might not be something which has been planned from the original with Type 003 when it's built, but it certainly is something I see happening now. And the interesting, while the Chinese UAV program is a very interesting thing to try and get into, mainly because some of them do have some very interesting names, and some of them seem to be actually, they seem to be kind of like Super Hornet to Hornet. You know what I mean? They have the same name, but you're going, hang on. That looks, or the Vought Corsair, the one which was prior to World War II versus the one during World War II. Very, very different aircraft, but they have the same name. So I'm looking down, and I think my suspicion would be if they're going to come from anyone, it would probably be the Gizu Aircraft Industry Corporation, who seem to be the ones who produce the really big, really heavy duty UAVs for the Chinese. But that is a sort of, it's a what's coming scenario. And the interesting thing is then, if you put it back to what is coming on our side, you know, what are the Americans building? What are the British building in terms of UAVs for their aircraft carriers? That's a whole different mill game.
I mean, I have a suspicion that at this point we may be looking at a scenario where, what's the best way to put it? I think the Chinese are going to use the 003 as a dual purpose vessel, but I still don't think it's going to be their frontline vessel. I don't think the 003 is going to reflect what they actually are planning to use their carrier fleet for, because as far as we know, they're only building one. And, you know, as we all know, if you have only one, you actually have none. The French are finding this out with Charles de Gaulle half the time. The Russians finding out with Kunitsov, etc. It's the reason the Royal Navy wouldn't allow the government to cut the Queen Elizabeth down to just the one ship. And we think we know that they're going for the Type 004, which is an even bigger ship, which will probably be, if it is an actual real thing, will probably be built in considerably larger numbers. So that's the ship that we should probably be thinking of as to how they're actually going to use it. With the 003s, I think they're probably going to use it partly to expand and develop their carrier capability. As I mentioned before, you know, instead of operating with a small handful of aircraft, now they're going to be trying to do carrier operations with larger air groups, whatever those happen to be made up of, and get a real sense for them of how to actually, you know, how to run a large carrier, however it is they want to use them in the future. But the second thing that I can definitely see them doing with the 003s is actually using it for a kind of force projection, because they've got the 055s, their big sort of almost cruiser types. They look all snazzy and modern. Now, with the best will in the world, Liaoning and Shandong, they look like relics of the Cold War, because, at least in Liaoning's case, it is a relic of the Cold War. It's not particularly impressive on the global stage. You know, if a Chinese group of, say, 055s and a few of the smaller escort craft show up with Liaoning in tow, or Shandong, or both, A, the fact they're going to look like, you know, like escorting a child with 16 knights is going to be fairly obvious, and B, it opens the realm of other people doing one-upmanship.
Yeah.
Because if, I mean, forget the USA for the moment, if the UK shows up with the current Queen Elizabeth group, or even India shows up once they get Victor Medicia in service. Both of those ships, if I've got the right, is it, or is it Vikram? I can never remember the Indian carriers, but whichever the new one is. If they show up, the Queen Elizabeth show up, if the maybe the French with Charles de Gaulle, or definitely if they eventually get their Charles de Gaulle replacement going at some point in the future, you know, there's a number of carriers out there that are bigger and significantly more impressive than either Liaoning or Shandong, and so they're not the kind of things you want to show off. You know, it would be the it'll be the World War II equivalent of showing up with, I don't know, with sort of showing up with your heavy cruise, with your town class and your county class, or if you're the Americans, with your Brooklyns and your New Orleans, etc. But then at the centerpiece of your force, you're tooling along with a pre-dreadnought.
Or HMS Hermes.
Yeah, something along those lines, yeah. Or Langley. Whereas the Type 003, that is actually big enough and impressive enough, dimensionally, flight deck length and beam-wise, albeit displacement-wise, it's a fair bit off of the Nimitzes and the Fords, but actual physical size-wise, in terms of length and breadth, it's fractionally off of the Fords. It's big enough to be impressive, and if you combine that with the big Type 055s,
you've got a very good statement.
Yeah, you've got a statement that nobody can one up simply by showing up with a bigger ship, because, you know, on paper, yes, people might go, oh yeah, well, if the US shows up with a Ford class, that's bigger than a 003. But for the general impression to the general public, etc., they're close enough in size, it may, near as much as it makes no difference. And because
and
they
people
also
expect the American one to be bigger, so that psychology of the scenario works against the Americans.
Yeah, and because
the fact
they have
the Chinese one looks so big compared to the Americans works for the Chinese.
Yeah. And again, in terms of the visual psychological impact, if you've got the 055s coming along for the ride, you know, as good as the platform as the Arleigh Burke is, it's smaller than a 055. And also, again, not disparaging its capabilities, but it doesn't look as modern as a 055. A 055 looks like a modern stealth warship. The Burkes, because of the fact that the design is, you know, almost as old as we are, they do look the part of a late Cold War ship. So if you have a theoretical battle group of, let's say, a Nimitz or a Ford rock up with half a dozen Burkes, and on the other side of the harbour there's a Type 003 with half a dozen 055s, the Chinese group's actually going to look the more impressive overall.
Basically, the American has to bring all the Zumwalts with them to have a chance of looking as impressive.
Yeah, you have to bring one of your three Zumwalts, and or you have to bring multiple carriers. At which point,
probably at least one of your Zumwalts. At which point, yeah, you are in a thing that looks weird.
But also at that point, it again, from almost a gunboat diplomacy perspective, it then makes the Americans look desperate, because the Chinese can initially pretend that this is a standard battle group deployment. Whereas if the Americans bring a Zumwalt, you know they're making an effort. So it puts them on the back foot. Now, obviously, at the moment, it would be the Chinese making an effort, because that would be their only battle group. The Americans can show up with, you know, almost a dozen of them. But that's, again, that's background knowledge that people who are a bit better informed know, whereas more easily impressed government officials in third world countries and general public won't necessarily understand. And, of course, the Chinese can also point out that, yes, this may be our only battle group, but we're building more. And guess what? The next carrier we show up with is going to be even bigger and better and more impressive than this one. So I suspect you might end up, once it's wound up into operational service, you might very well see it going around and showing the flag on, you know, the east coast of Africa or the west coast of South America and all these other places that they're quite happily getting in their pocket.
This talk brings to mind the formation of the new anti-submarine warfare group in the Atlantic.
Mm. Someone obviously liked on Tom Hanks.
Entirely based on Burkes,
mm,
which I didn't really realise were anti-submarine.
Well, they're really not.
But they're the only things that the US has that can do the job. Because if the Burkes are not ASW ships, the Tycos are even less ASW ships. At which point, what else are you going to do the ASW ship? Use the Constellation.
I think there's been a frantic conversation with the Royal Navy and the Canadian Navy about whether or not a Type 23 or a Halifax class can be in attendance anywhere nearby.
Well, the thing is, I mean, they can do ASW. They've got sonar. They're just not very well set up for it as compared to how well they are set up for AAW warfare. But again, Now, what else are you going to use? The bigger ships are even less suitable. They don't have any frigates yet. The Constellation class would be doing the role, but they haven't built them yet. And I don't think anybody in the US Navy values their career so little that they're going to put half a dozen LCS together, send them out into the Atlantic and hope that they're all functional and or afloat by the end of a deployment.
So what brought this on? Was it simply the movie Greyhound? I mean, come on, guys. You know, you've got something a bit more original in the thinking.
Well,
I can't really see these Russian hordes of submarines swarming through the GIUK gap at the moment, though.
On the one hand, yeah.
No, great, but if you deployed it into the Pacific, it would look like you were escalating things. Whereas if you deploy it to the Atlantic and start doing your practice for anti-submarine warfare there, it's like the British in the interwar period. It's a way of raising your anti-submarine warfare skills without pointing out that you're building against someone else, or someone specifically.
But on the other hand, though, is that, to be fair, you know, much as the Russian carrier program is a bit of a running joke, and they're, apart from the Gorshkovs, their surface ship replacement program is kind of so stop-start, you'd think it was a stop-motion Wallace and Gromit animation. But their submarine program has been quietly clipping along at a fairly significant pace. I know we talked about the Belgrad and the little, I've forgotten the name of it, the little mini sub it's got attached to it last time. But, you know, they are replacing their Deltas and Typhoons with new ballistic missile subs. I think it's the Borays. And they're also gradually phasing out their Cold War SSN fleet with the new Janssen types, which seem to be, interestingly, taking more cues from the Virginias than the Astutes, in that they seem to be kind of a combined, especially the Virginia Block 5s, they seem to be a combined SSGN-SSN platform. But, you know, the Russians were still pretty good at sub-design, and people who know a bit more about that element of things seem to be taking them very seriously. So whilst the Russian Navy as a whole entity may no longer be the kind of threat that it was in the late 80s and early 90s, the Russian submarine fleet is probably still as big a threat, if not possibly even a greater threat, than it was during that time period. So given that Russian sub technology in all likelihood is at least a generation or two ahead of Chinese submarine technology, and it remains the Russians' main area of technological exertible expertise, I think it kind of makes a lot of sense, because one, you still want to contain the Russian fleet if you're the Western allies. Yeah. You don't want to run rampant over the Atlantic and get advantages that they didn't get during the Cold War. But on the other hand, you know, if you're training your ASW groups on the Russians, if you're trying to hunt Janssens, then the odds are if you end up deploying elsewhere, you're going to have a heck of a lot easier time going after the current generation of Chinese nuclear subs than you ever are against the Janssens. So, you know, the kind of thing of train hard so that you can fight easily.
Yeah, that's all. That's certainly the case, and if anyone noticed I've been a bit quiet for the last few minutes, it's because I've been buried under several kilograms of fluff, which decided it was going to take up my lap. The point is, though, for I think when we're dealing with the Russian submarines and we're talking about the Chinese, is that we have to start thinking also, why are they sending these things out there? And you were talking about the Chinese deployment. This is another reason to have uncrewed aircraft on the carrier, because if they go out around the world, what are people mostly buying? Uncrewed aircraft. I think is the other fluff, probably that is Jamie's fluff complaining that that they're not in a lap, whereas mine's in my lap, because I heard a woof. they're complaining they're not getting parity of treatment and parity of laps here. But no, if you're to going around the world and you're basically consider it like a mobile arms fair. This is what they carry going around the world, and if the Americans have to turn up with a special carrier fleet, that makes it even look makes them look even better. But if they're going around, they're going, oh, and you see this lovely piece of technology? Oh, you can buy that.
They'll have to compete with the Turkish, though.
Well, yes, but you know, the Turkish are Erdogan's doing some very interesting things at the moment. I think he's possibly going to find himself in trouble at some point. He's playing quite a dangerous balancing act, and if he makes one wrong step, he could find himself in a lot of trouble.
It seems he's rather confident in what he's doing, and you know, playing a bit of a knife edge there between Russia and the West, isn't he?
In my experience, acrobats are always confident until something goes really, really something goes wrong.
Yes, but there are also acrobats who make a career out of it.
Yeah.
Until something goes horribly wrong.
Yeah. I don't know. There are several things which are quite interesting. And I think this feeds into the fact that both America and Britain, it's kind of interesting. The British, of course, announced the SSNR program after the AUKUS agreement. And now both Britain and America have stepped up their replacement DD designs. The DDX has had more stuff published about it this week. And let's be honest, that does sound pretty... How do I put
ambitious.
This? I'm just hoping they don't fall into the same trap they did last time. I'm hoping they don't. They managed to keep Donald Rumsfeld out of the design team.
Yes, but he's got plenty of successors. So, you know, who knows? I guess we'll wait and see.
Oh.
I suppose it depends on what sort of degree of turnover they have and whether they have to relearn the lessons again, because it has been a long time since those decisions were made.
Yes, it does. And it's when you start looking back to it, the DDX program, DDGX program as it's being called, has probably been fitting and starting for about the last decade, and the US Navy isn't looking to buy any till 2028. So we're still 7 years away. There is plenty of time for people to shoehorn random technologies into these design, the design. But the more and more, one of the actual proposals for it, and we can be worried about this, one of the actual proposals for it apparently at one point was a supersized Independence class.
Why?
Which one? It sailed.
Look, at least it wasn't a supersized Freedom class.
Just throwing good money after bad is not the way you actually accomplish anything, apart from make some in political interest very rich.
Oh God, Hansel.
Well, I don't know.
What I was laughing, you know, the US Navy.
What's the problem? What's the problem with the design? Is it the hull form, or is it the demands on their speed?
Hull form, demands on speed, and the fact that they were apparently proposing to make it out of like aluminium again.
Yeah. I was going to say, the Trimaran ones have got a decent amount of deck space.
Oh, they have that.
Sorry, behind the bridge. For the bridge, there's probably barely enough there to hold the Mormon gun. But
well, let's be honest. If it's expanded up to 15,000 tons, I'd hope there'd be more space in front of the bridge. I'd hope.
But what do you need? What do you need a multi-hull vessel for if you're not going for 40 knots anyway? So.
Well,
as I said before, in theory, the idea of a supersized trimaran of that kind of layout could make a certain amount of sense once you get up to the size that you can actually have a hangar deck underneath the flight deck.
Well, but, you know, the Royal Navy has already tried. You know,
yeah.
You built Triton, which we
was a study model.
Australia rented for a while as a patrol vessel.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is,
I don't see the Type 26 looking anything like it.
No, I mean, the thing is, one, it requires a certain minimum size, but also two, it's the general concept because it allows you to have a large, relatively large hangar and flight deck on an overall smaller hull. It's not a direct endorsement of the particular hull form for that particular type of ship, because that particular vessel, as we said, has been designed with this 40 knot speed in mind, and there's an awful lot of compromises that go into getting a ship to go that quickly, which
Triton wasn't that fast though.
No, but then if you look at the layout of Triton, admittedly it's a somewhat smaller ship, but if you look at the layout of Triton and the layout of some of the on paper proposed Trimaran carriers, it is a somewhat different overall hull plan as compared to the LCS or the Trimaran LCS. So you don't really want to just go supersizing that particular hull, because you're going to end up with a lot of compromises built into a ship that definitely isn't going to be going 40 knots, which are going to compromise your other capabilities. So I think taking that either of the LCS hull forms and trying to do anything else with them is pretty much a dead end because of the compromises they've had to build into them for the LCS program. Because if you take those compromises out and revise the design to such an extent to eliminate those compromises, you've effectively designed a brand new ship, at which point you might as well have just designed a brand new ship. It's the same kind of thing of, like, you know, things like battle cruisers. When we're talking about the true battle cruisers pre-World War One, and people are talking about trying to get them to fight in the battle line or refit them to fight in the battle line, and you look at it and just go, no, you know, the length to beam ratio is all wrong, the hull form is all wrong. Even if you slap additional armor on it, you're going to have so many compromises and end up with a ship that has fewer guns, maybe marginally more speed, and the armor layout is not going to be anything like as good. So why bother? And yes, I know, I'm sure somebody's frantically typing away, yes, but then, you know, the Der Flinger class, look at the actual coverage of the Der Flinger's 12-inch belt as compared to the coverage of the main armor belt on an actual battleship. Just because you have a 12-inch armor thickness in one location doesn't mean you have it in anything like the amount of coverage you need for an actual battleship.
And for those who don't know, if you haven't heard it, get on the Monday version. Monday's 4th of October 2021's Armchair Admirals is all about battle cruisers. So you're going to probably hear me and Drac saying that a lot.
Well, you won't hear me. That's going to be the one Armchair Admirals I'm going to miss, because I'm going to be Lord. Up in... Yes, I know. My Hugh Dennis streak is broken.
I'm going to be there without you. Goodness gracious me. The thing is, the battle cruisers are often used as examples for things that they can chop and change. And you can, but actually, they show exactly why it's difficult. They show exactly what the problems are with this idea of chopping and changing a ship, of designing it so it's so you can fit what you wanted to do. And, you know, this is also the problem for the US Navy at the moment. They have a fleet which was, let's be honest, in the 1990s and early 2000s, wasn't designed around fighting a war. You don't repeat LCS. You don't design LCS if you think you're actually going to be fighting a peer enemy. You don't. I love the Arleigh Burke design. The Arleigh Burke is lovely, but you've got flight ones, flight twos, flight two ways, flight threes, and I think flight fours as well. Now, at a certain point, someone should probably have gone after the Flight 2A, hang on, we better have a new destroyer design. And they do, but it turns into the Zumwalt, because it becomes a Christmas tree that gets everyone's ideas on. And the Zumwalt is a great hull. What they should have done is built Flight 1 Zumwalt, as a with the hull, and then gone right then for flight two. Well, we can add in that we can add it, you know, and then possibly now be talking about another type of destroyer. You know, that is what you do, and then they wouldn't have the problem, as we were talking about earlier, where if the Chinese carrier group turns up, of looking quite so. How do I put this? We all know, and most of the people listening to this know how effective an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer is. But compared to the Type 55, it doesn't look as powerful. Whereas a Zumwalt being there looks powerful. It looks modern. And partially that's probably because the Arleigh Burkes have been now around for so long in such great numbers. They no longer have the impact because they are part of the furniture.
Yeah.
Would you consider that fair?
To an extent. I mean, at the same time, we've got to acknowledge, obviously, the various flights represent increases in capabilities, increases in systems. They've had refits, etc., etc.
But agreed.
But fundamentally, the core design of the Arleigh Burkes, as we mentioned earlier, is a Cold War era vessel. And much as it might shock some people to know, but you know, the Cold War ended 31 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And the ship was designed before then. It is a little bit, I mean, it's the capabilities wise it's not long in the tooth, but the actual fundamental hull form is long in the tooth. And for goodness sake, the Zumwalts are effectively a late Cold War program.
Let's be honest,
with an extremely long gestation period.
The Arleigh Burkes are the flower of the 1980s technology. Arleigh Burke herself might have been commissioned in 1991, and the fact that she's still in service, she's home ported in Rota, Spain, but Arleigh Burke herself is still in service. DGG 51 is still in service. She commissioned in 1991, so 30 years ago. She was laid down in 1988, which means, let's be honest, they probably had firmed up the design and worked out what they were building by 1986, which, if you consider starting work, probably started work on them in the 1970s. This is the design you're dealing with. They haven't got to flight four. I'm sorry. I was getting it wrong because they've got the flight ones, the flight two A is flight twos, the flight two A's, the flight two A restarts, the flight two A TIs, technology insertions, and then the flight threes. And that's the thing. Your first ship in your class is over 30 years old and still in service, and they haven't even named the DDG 139, which is supposed to be built by Ingalls, which will be the last ship in the class. They haven't even started construction on the last Type 2A technology insertion. That's the Patrick Gallagher, which is going to be actually started work after the second Type 3, Flight 3, which is the Louis H. Wilson. Good God, I'm sure they have good names, but one of them's been called Bad Cochran, named for a USS senator.
I was going to say that, you know, maybe there was just a few too many eggs put in the Zumwalt basket.
Yes, it needed to be. The Zumwalt was a destroyer. And it needed to. What they needed to do basically was go, right then, what do we need to have put in? Well, as much as I love the fancy gun system, they should have probably stuck with the advanced gun system rather than trying for the rail gun. And they should have just been sort of happy to get into a good service, a good modern destroyer of a modern power kit.
As we've discussed on previous podcasts, there's kind of this lost couple of decades where they don't seem to have been able to figure out what they wanted to do.
Mm.
And that, I think, is still
To a certain extent, the case. I mean, there's, as we said before, the constellations show a way forward, and that perhaps this thinking has resolved itself to a certain degree, but they still haven't finalised what the new large surface combatant's going to be. And this is the thing. It's we're no longer in a world where ships are being built simultaneously with each other, and therefore you can roughly approximate capabilities to within a ballpark of each other. So, you know, it's not like the pre-World War One dreadnought arms race where everybody's building classes of battleships every year, or the late 1930s where everybody's building battleships and cruisers pretty much simultaneously, so you can expect a broadly similar set of performances. We're talking about a period where some nations have been building iterations of certain ships for years and years and years. Other nations are relying on ships that they bought or built 1, 2, 3, 4 decades ago. And other nations have been building gradual iterations, sort of small class iterations over time, and then going big on when they think they've hit a sweet spot. But what that means is that the baseline capability of the hull, before you integrate any weapon systems and everything, the baseline capability of the hull and therefore its potential routes to expansion and new systems are going to be very different for very different navies. Now, obviously, we talk about the 055s a lot. The Chinese aren't just building the 055s. You know, those are their big headline ships. They're building a lot of smaller vessels. But those various vessels that they're building at the moment, the Lyder class, as and when the Russians ever get around to building that, etc., they're all newer hulls, which means they have a lot more. A, they physically have longer lifespans left on them, assuming similar build quality. And B, there's going to be been more thought about what are now near future weapon systems gone into them. So you need there needs to be a sort of a transition over again, because if you're thinking of, again, cast back to historical terms, a 30-year or so gap between being first constructed and now in service is a similar level of gap to where the Queen Elizabeths were in the mid part of World War II. Because bear in mind, the Queen Elizabeths built, constructed, coming into service in the early part of the 1910s. Mm-hmm. So by the early to mid 1940s, they're also hitting that 30-year bracket. And I think that probably provides a fairly decent sort of allegory, because, you know, you look at Warspite, Queen Elizabeth, and Valiant before it fell off a dry dock. They've been modernized. They were capable, still capable ships. They weren't quite frontline the way that the King George V's were. But they were still pretty darn capable. You wouldn't want to mess with them in a fight, especially a night fight. But they were no longer the latest and greatest ships. And fundamentally, I think the level of technology change between the 1910s and the late 1930s, early 1940s, before we get that massive step change of radar and aircraft and everything, was probably not actually as great because of the treaty system and because of the Great Depression as the difference with technology between the early 1990s and now. So modernized and updated Arleigh Burke is still going to be a very nasty front, very, very nasty combatant, but fundamentally they are reaching the end of their design lives, I think.
I mean, it's the same problem that the US Air Force has, surely, that, you know, they have all these very effective, very good for their time, i.e. 1980s, 1990s, aircraft in their inventory, but they're getting so much more expensive to run. And when they run them, they have to run them with kid gloves because, you know, they risk having bits fall off them and, you know, taking a pilot with them. So I'm sure that you probably wouldn't want to run Arleigh Burke Sr. At full power across the Atlantic. So,
yeah.
Well, it is in the Mediterranean squadron.
I think if you cast
there's a big rock in the way.
Yeah, if you cast your mind back even further, I think there's a
certain degree of parallels with the 19th century Royal Navy, because, you know, they fought Napoleon way back. Then they participated in the Crimean War. The Russians kind of refused to do the actual fleet battle thing, but, you know, they had the transport logistics, shore bombardment operations. There was a good deal of shooting up of various fortified islands and such. So they had a degree of, I guess, combat experience from that. And of course, during that, and then immediately after that, you had the ironclad race in the 1860s and 1870s, especially against France. So there was competition, there was, you know, technological development. One side pulled ahead, then the other side pulled ahead, etc. And the Royal Navy at least had some idea of what it was supposed to be doing, even if some of the ways and means and ships that they used to do it were a little bit bizarre. But then you get to the end of the 19th century and France has gone off on its own little Je N'Ecole route, which effectively kind of cripples its ability to later build up a competing battle fleet in the numbers and technological level they need to. And as you enter the 20th century, that's where you kind of see this wobble where the Royal Navy is going, yes, we're building a bunch of ships, and theoretically some of them are leaders, but we've also got this massive collection of older ships, and we don't really want to get rid of them, and we don't really know exactly what it is we want to be doing in the future other than keeping up with other people. And it all gets a little bit fuzzy.
There's so much technology coming in. There's so much, and no one wants to make any decision unless they take the wrong route.
You look at all the various cruisers that they're throwing out at that point. You go from Blake and Blenheim to Powerful and Terrible via the Orlandos, then over to the Cressys. Then you get the Monmouth. Somebody thought they were a good idea, and then you have this massive the last generation of armored cruisers. They can't quite decide what balance of 9.2 versus 7.5 inch guns they have. You can see it's kind of, they know roughly what they want to do, but they're not entirely clear on how they're going to do it or who they're going to be facing. And then Germany starts its rise, Fischer comes in, and everything kind of snaps into focus, and you get a massive clear the slate of older ships, get this new program in place, start building good ships, start building them in large numbers, and you get the fleet that fights the First World War. And I think to a certain degree, the US Navy is kind of in that late 1890s, 1900s phase. They've got a lot of older ships. They're keeping them around because they have to have a large fleet because they're the global hegemon. So obviously we want a big fleet, but we can't afford to pay for massive numbers of new ships, and we're experimenting with, you know, ships that are coming out in odds and ones and twos and threes, and other ships that are not necessarily working out as well as we'd hoped they would. And now you've got the Germany analog, rising naval power, wants to compete on the world stage, probably doesn't necessarily want to have the business of having to take over the global policeman role, but certainly would like to be able to tell everybody else to shove out of its business and let it have what it wants. And I guess then the question there is, who is going to be the US Admiral Fisher to come in and go and persuade Congress, you know, actually, yes, we've spent all these billions of dollars, but you know what? As Fisher said, scrap the lot. Get rid of the stuff that doesn't work.
I can offer Admiral Jerry Kidd. He's done quite well for the Royal Navy.
But, you know, you need to... Somebody needs to step in and go, you know, okay, yes, we spent a lot of money on the LCS. They didn't work. Forget it. Lots of constellations. You know, yes, the Tycho's great. Yes, we're kind of keeping them around because we don't have a direct equivalent.
We just need to build something. We've got the Zumwalt hull. Start churning something out.
We don't currently have them. So, you know, the solution isn't keep the geriatrics around in a combat role. The solution is get rid of them and start building their replacements. And the same with the Burkes. I mean, the Burks are slightly newer, but still, you know, eventually someone's going to have draw. Well, they have drawn a line under the production run, but someone's going to have to then go, okay, now this is what we're going to build on mass to replace them. In a lot of ways, the US submarine program, weirdly enough, a bit like the Russian submarine program, seems to be about the only clear path where things have been somewhat working, because they
is
have
that to, because I, submarines have to. Because let's be honest, submarines have to. Submarines are never at peace.
If you make a submarine that doesn't quite work, it tends to end very badly.
I was going to say, you might end up with a few spares to buy back off of Australia anyway, because we still haven't figured out where we're going to get the crews from yet.
Pay them more.
I know
that's anathema.
In nicest way, you've got about a decade to sort that one out, so I'm not going to worry about that one too much. It's one of the things when I see the current press articles which keep going, we need answers to this right now, and you're going, why?
Because
why do you need an answer
for a newspaper?
Because I want to know.
Because in the nicest way, it's going to take time.
Now.
It takes time. And the worst thing you can do is come up with a solution right now and then have to change it in a couple of years' time because it doesn't work. So you need to fix it. And then someone's going to have to announce there's problems.
I mean, that works. Like all these things, they work on a sliding scale. And that scale is generally in the shape of a bell curve. So,
and also,
you know, when you're getting yourself 8 submarines and they're nuclear powered and you've got no nuclear industry, it's still going to be an issue, and I still don't think that you're going to be handing over all your spare technicians all that fast. So anyway, that's a side issue.
You're going to have to pay.
I mean, doesn't Australia have some version of like celebrity love desert island deathmatch pop star X Factor to distract the media for 5 seconds?
Surely Strictly Come Dancing has started out there now.
Perhaps we could run a show that is, you know, can you crew our future nuclear submarine?
Yeah.
Cool. Here's a nuclear reactor. Mm. Here's a poor, unsuspecting South Pacific island.
make it a state's competition. Like day 37 and Queensland's nuclear reactor is kicking along quite nicely. New South Wales, well, they're all growing glowing green and they've sprouted 4 extra limbs, so probably the bottom of the rankings this week. Vote now if you'd like which one you'd like to see go forward to the next week, or we starve them of uranium.
Isn't it Western Australia's premier who's currently going around telling everyone that Australia's being mean to China?
Possibly. They've got the most to lose because that's where most of their iron ore that they dig out of the ground goes. So I'm sure he's representing his billionaire constituents. Yeah.
But yeah, you know,
I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what pans out in the near future. It's going to be a case of, are people going to turn around, fuck up their ideas and go, yeah, okay, we're in a competition, we should actually compete, you know, shake themselves out of this mindset it's a monopoly.
Spend all their time trying to figure out what brand of shoes they should wear.
I'm voting they'll probably do their shoes.
Or figure out if they can cancel the Chinese Navy on Twitter.
Oh, God, don't get me started.
If we say enough mean things about them, they won't be allowed to use social media, and that surely is the end of everything.
Well, honestly, actually, I have to say, on the subject of the Chinese Navy and social media, have you been following their Twitter?
Yes, it's quite amusing.
Yes. Also,
Comments and threats to the Queen Elizabeth battle group were highly amusing.
Yes. They were actually quite pleased with the Queen Elizabeth. The tweets that I saw were quite complimentary, that it went from point A to point B on a direct line and obeyed the laws of the South China Sea.
I mean, someone should tell them they don't actually...
Then you went and mucked it up by sending that destroyer down, or frigate, through the Taiwan Strait. So, you know. Mm.
Yeah, we sent a Type 23 frigate, which was kind of cruel because...
And then they flipped out to the point that you'd think we had actually legitimately strapped barrels of opium to the decks again.
Well,
let's be honest. The thing is, Most people are looking at the Type 23, and again, they have been around a long time. Most people, you know, they're kind of picturing. People are going, why are they flipping? I actually got messages from them going, why are they so upset about a Type 23? It can't do anything to them. It's an anti-submarine warfare frigate. It's a harpoon, I'm sure, a vital threat to the Chinese nation state.
It's the principle of the thing. They'd be just as upset as if they'd sent their carrier through the English Channel.
Well, the thing is, I think someone in the Royal Navy has either been listening to us or potentially actually reading a history book, which, you know, Royal Navy officers do occasionally do.
They do.
Because, it harks back to the, you might remember several dozen episodes ago when we were talking about modern gunboat diplomacy. It's the perfect foil for the Chinese, because if the UK had sent the entire carrier battle group down the straits, then it would be a challenge and something that China could meet force on force. And, you know, oh yes, the UK fears us so much they have to send their half of their entire navy to just to pass near our holy and sacred waters, because, you know, with the Middle Kingdom and all that. But if you send a Type 45 or two, then it's a similar thing of, oh yes, the Royal Navy is so fearful of coming near us, they have to send their anti-aircraft warfare destroyers just in case glorious China decides to remove them. Or you send a rather old Type 23 toodling along down just going, hello, because everybody knows there's practically nothing it could actually do if the Chinese wanted to do anything about it. But by inference, the Royal Navy is saying, yes, but we also know you're not going to do anything about it, with the further subtle inference of, you cowards. which, for a culture like the Chinese, that's
a red flag to a bull.
Yeah, but the Chinese who place a lot of emphasis on, you know, saving face and hierarchy and stuff, it's exactly the right level of poke, 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 can't touch me, can't touch me, can't touch me, that gunboat diplomacy is made of, which is why they flipped out so much. They'd probably flip out less if you sent a bigger force.
Let's be honest, which one did we send? Now, the Royal Navy has some Type 23s, which are far better, which you have to say tend to somehow get the better tech, somehow always seem to get the best tech and best crews. It's HMS Richmond.
Is it their name?
Yeah, HMS Richmond. And HMS Richmond was the one who went down there. And also, have a look at HMS Richmond's track record. When the Royal Navy is trolling people, it does tend to be HMS Richmond which is sent for the job. She has a long tradition of being used as the Royal Navy's, oh, we've sent a Type 23. What are you going to do about it?
So the Richmond is the Royal Navy's coattails.
Pretty much. But this is the point about the Royal Navy building the Type 31s. Because this is, again, why I think that the Type 31s, we need to actually have more than five. Because I can see them attached to battle groups, as I've told you, that they're going to be attached to the point defense flak frigate. But also, that's the perfect vessel for the Royal Navy to send down the Taiwan Straits and go, hello, you're going to get, this is our weakest frigate. Are you really going to get upset about it?
We could have sent a river.
By the time you finally get around to building them, though, you might be needing them.
They're being constructed as we speak. They've started cutting steel.
That would imply they've designed them.
Have.
It's just no one's actually told the shipyard what they're supposed to be doing. Come on, this is the MOD. they've ordered the ships. They're like, yes, well, the plans are in the post. Which, let me tell you, is not the shadow of what it used to be.
HMS Venture was laid down 23rd of September 2021. So she was laid down a little bit over a week ago. And their design is they're going to be carrying 24 C-sector anti-air missiles. 57mm is their main gun. Two 40mm secondary guns. General purpose machine guns and mini guns. No one's decided yet on the SSM, but that's probably because they're going to get the interim surface to surface missile, which no one's yet decided what it is going to be. But naval strike missile is most likely, because the French over the AUKUS issue are playing silly buggers over the anti-ship missile, which we're supposed to be developing with them.
Okay. So they have actually settled on a design. Yes. I'm a bit behind the times on that.
It's the Overhulfolk class. Basically, they've nicked the Danish frigate design.
Okay. Hopefully, they paid some royalties.
Yes, but this my problem. There is a reason I keep calling them Type 31s as if they don't have a name, because do you know what the class name is has been listed as?
Inspiration class.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my God.
We talked about this on a previous episode.
Yeah, I must be my
nightmare. I blacked it from my memory.
I'm still not entirely sure of the as I said on that episode, I appreciate the idea of the inspiration class, and 4 out of 5, whilst I disagree fundamentally with the concept of why they're doing it, I much prefer more traditional Royal Navy class names. I can at least see the point in 4 out of 5 ships. If you want to look at it from a completely clinical perspective, 4 out of 5 of them, the qualities inherent in the name, or that you can infer from the name and those ships' histories, do match the idea of inspiration, even though having I suppose we have the town class and the county class, and there was never an HMS town or HMS county. So I suppose having a class name that's separate from the ship names works to a degree, but, and big emphasis on this one, HMS Campbelltown, HMS Campbelltown as an inspiration. The raid on the St. Nazaire port is a remarkable feat. I probably almost certainly had one of my great uncles was almost certainly there. So I'm in no way disparaging that feat, but the inspiration should be the raid. The ship was a gigantic floating bomb. So I'm not entirely sure on the idea of your inspiration for crewing this ship is we were a gigantic floating bomb.
And that, honestly, there are other raids, there are other names they could have gone with for a name of a ship which wasn't a giant floating bomb, which was doing a thing. They could have gone with one of the tribal class destroyer names. They could have gone with, I don't know, Cossack. Which Zubian. They could probably
that would have rubbed it in the face of the Russians over Crimea.
Yes, and that would be another C, and it'd been fine. But you know, I have to say, I can understand Formidable. After all, when she was last an aircraft carrier, she did try to get involved in a gunfight, so making her a gun frigate, I can understand that. Active is a traditional frigate name. And destroyer name, Bulldog is, Ventura is.
Well, let's face it, the only reason why they want to build a Bulldog is so they could paint one on the side of it.
Mm, yeah, I mean, the Royal Navy is getting into snazzy camouflage skins these days again, which is great. So, you know, I think if they're not going to go back to the
Victorian... That's the other thing the US Navy could do. Let's be honest.
Yeah, but do you really want to paint the faces of a bunch of senators on the side of their ships?
No. I'm talking about snazzy camo schemes, because we were talking about the Arleigh Burke showing up. They don't look as modern or anything. But if they have a snazzy World War II inspired camo scheme, let's be honest, you look at the Chinese ships and you go, yeah, you might look sleek, but oh god, that looks snazzy.
Mind you, actually, to be fair, though, the majority of the US camo schemes late war were pretty much grey, and the early war stuff was a kind of dark blue, which I can kind of see.
1943, they got creative. 1943, yeah. 1944, but second half of 1944, they went back to the flat. So.
Yeah. I've said before, I much prefer them go back to the Great White Fleet scheme. Apart from anything else, it'll force them to actually paint their blasted ships once in a while to keep up appearances. But if the Royal Navy's not going to go back to black, white and buff, they might as well just throw random camo schemes on everything just to confuse everyone.
Well, that's what the Royal Navy's having fun with that one. Anyway, I think we are close on time. Yes.
This is my sole purpose of existence, is to be your alarm clock.
But no, they are, the Type 31s are being built, and apparently they're being ordered by other people.
I swear that's going to be your epitaph, Jamie. It's like Jamie Seidel, father, husband, journalist, cat herder.
Oh, I don't know.
As opposed to my epitaph is just going to be check once a year to make sure he's still there.
Mine's going to be a giant 3D Blackburn at this rate, floating around.
or possibly, welcome to the Drakenafell Memorial Graveyard. Here lies Drakenafell. Here lies all the people he took with him. That would be a fairly cool one.
Here lies all the books he bought but never got around to scan.
Yes. His mausoleum is made of his entire library crystallized. it may block out several large buildings.
Oh,
all right. I guess I'll catch you guys next week.
All right,
take care. Thank you.
Next week. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.